Welcome and welcome to all the folks who've joined us here at the Temple of Humanity. And we're here for the second week. And let us begin by acknowledging the Burramadigal people of the Darug Nation, upon whose land we not only are sitting and living, but upon whose land we are also practicing our spiritual path. Just near to here, so for those of you not in Australia, we are just over the road, in fact, just almost adjacent to the Parramatta River, after which the Parramatta suburb is named. And that was, of course, the lifeline for the local people here. And it was the especially noted as the place where there is the fresh water from the mountains, which meets the highest level of the salt water from the sea, washes up the Parramatta River. Okay. let us recite the devotions to the Triple Gem.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Itipiso bhagava arahaṃ sammasambuddho vijjacharana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhammasarathi Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavate svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhitiko akaliko ehipasiko opanaiko Pachatam veditabo vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savakasangho Nyahaya patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Samichi patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Ahunam chattari purisa yugani Atta purisa pugala Esa bhagavato savaka sangho Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakirneyo anjali karaniyo Anuttaram punyaketam lokasati.
Okay, very good. I'm very grateful to the Buddha that he gave us some simple devotions and verses to recite. I'm just reminded how in the place we're in here now, the Temple of Humanity, mostly is a devotional shrine for various Hindu gods and deities and so on. And so in Buddhism, we also have a devotional practice or a devotional dimension. And sometimes it's true, sometimes the devotional dimension seems to overwhelm other dimensions so that it's all that's left and it's the only thing that seems to be there. But, I mean, it's not a bad thing, right? People doing devotions to the Buddha and elevating their mind to that is still a good thing. There's just a lot more that we could be doing. So I've got a couple of people coming in. Welcome. How are you going? This is a temple of humanity. Are we all humans here? That's good. I don't know what we're going to be doing about all the non-humans who are visiting. I think they're probably okay. I think they're probably welcome as well. Anyway, welcome, Rowini. Just checking, Rowini, you're a lawyer? I didn't say that lawyers were not human, okay? I didn't say that, right? That was just your guilty conscience. All right. So even though the practice of devotions is certainly not all there is to Buddhism, and those of you who know me would know that I tend to, I like the suttas, I like meditation, and I like other things as well. But right from the beginning, I've also been somebody who's had a lot of faith in the Buddha's teachings. I don't know why. I don't know how to explain it. It's not something that I can rationalize at all, but it's just something that I felt from the very first times that I encountered Buddhism. The very first people that I met who were Buddhists seemed to have something special. I don't know whether they had anything special or whether that was just my projection. But there's always been something in myself that has been inspired to follow the Buddhist path, and has always brought that sense of devotion, without which the Dhamma tends to end up a bit dry and a bit joyless. So I think it's really a great act of beneficence that the Buddha has given us these ways of doing chanting that we can all join in together. Many years ago, this group is a continuation. We discussed doing the chanting, and the overwhelming feeling at the time was that people wanted to do chanting in Pali rather than chanting in English. And we've always kept up since then. And I think there's something special about Pali. There's something special about speaking the language of the Buddha, and just about feeling that sense of connection. And I also think practically it's also very useful because it gives you some, feel for the language, which can, for those of you who, pretty much anybody who studies Pali seriously would begin by reciting these verses. But also it gives you the ability when you travel or go to different places or mix with different communities that you can recognize what they're doing and participate and take part. So pretty much anywhere in the Theravada world, they'll be doing these chants. They might be doing some other ones as well. They might be chanting them in a different style, but at least you'll be able to recognize them and take part. So the purpose of these chants, of course, is to elevate the mind. And very often these chants are recited before doing meditation, or else people might recite the five precepts before doing meditation for the same purpose, to elevate the mind. And so most of us we've been doing various things throughout the day, and that applies to monastics just as much to lay people. We have various duties, various studies, or various things that we might be doing during the day. And sometimes we're able to practice continually all the time, but for the most part, we have other things on as well. And so it's useful to have a chance to have a bit of a break and to use the chanting for reflection and for bringing joy to the mind and elevating the mind. I still remember very fondly my time at Wat Manachat when I was introduced to the practice of chanting. Like my first Buddhist retreat I did was at Wat Rampung, where there wasn't any devotional things at all. Like we just walking and sitting, that's it, like nothing else. I mean, the monastery did their devotional chanting and so on, but the meditation, the retreatants didn't. So when I went to Wat Manachat and we were all participating in the life of the villagers and so on, and we would do the same chanting that was done by the Thai Sangha in the Ajahn Chah tradition Sangha. Obviously, we mostly used Pali and English rather than in the Wat Pa Pong, so Ajahn Chah tradition, they usually do Thai Pali chanting, Pali-Thai chanting, using the Thai translations done by Ajahn Buddhadasa. So we would usually do Thai English, except when we chanted with the local villagers. We usually do Pali English, but when we chanted with the local villagers, we would do Pali and Thai. So I still remember that feeling of like going out to the sala in the evening, and when, you know, after the heat of the day is starting to dissipate, and that feeling of kind of like the sun going down, and that cool feeling of just like having that opportunity to re-enter that sacred space and to help to create that sacred space. So we, you know, a space isn't sacred just because it happens to be that way. It's sacred because of what people do in that space. And so when we perform these devotions, we elevate that space. And so you can do that at home as well, when you're establishing your meditation practice, to do some devotions, to do that chanting like we've done today, can help you to create that vibe that this space and this time is my time for meditation. And it helps to orient your mind and raise it above the concerns of your everyday life. So that's just a few words for this evening on the practice of chanting and why we do these devotions. And I should mention that normally in Buddhism, normally we would also offer some flowers and light some incense and candles on the shrine as well to sort of complete the puja. And again, like my memory at Wat Manachat, you know, is like usually when I first arrived there, Ajahn Pasano was the abbot, and he would always arrive there. He would always, he'd always be very mindful and very dignified and devotional in the way that he would, you know, place the incense on the shrine. He would light it. It was this sort of performance of this series of steps that he was clearly using as a way of demonstrating that mindful presence to which we should be bringing to our practice. So these are not just devotion to, you know, the Buddha out there and asking for the Buddha's blessings, but these are ways in which we can learn to embody those qualities and those properties of the Buddha and to practice mindfulness through our faith. All right, so for today, let's do some meditation, and we can do some mindfulness of breathing meditation for the next 20 minutes or so. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Don't go chasing after your thoughts. Don't be giving importance to them. Don't be worrying about who you are, what you're doing, how you're going. Don't be worried about anything. Nothing to worry about. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Letting your breath calm you down. Staying with the breath as it rocks you and lulls you and soothes you. Trusting where the breath wants to take you. Feeling that soothing, cool energy. So now nearing the end of the meditation. Bring your mind back into awareness of what's around you and take a minute to reflect back on the meditation, asking yourself, what happened? How did my mind change? What was different? What felt the same as before? What's the emotions that my mind was going through? What are the thoughts? How does the mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so let's have a break for a couple of minutes and then come back for some Dhamma talk. All right, so kicking off with a question from Marion. Thanks for that. So, welcome everybody. Most of you have been around, but just to let you know, I'm doing a series of talks on dependent origination. And I promised that this series of talks would be uncompromising and that we would take no prisoners. So I'm not responsible, no matter how many bodies are left strewn astray as we go through. I don't care. So far, many of you have come back, which means either I'm doing something that works or else you're gluttons for punishment or both. Mike from New Zealand says, zit. I know exactly what you mean, Mike. That makes perfect sense to me. Or is that exit? Anyway, whatever. Marion asks, Marion asks, Bhante, what's about my translation of Naparang Itatayati? There's nothing further for this place. And what's the meaning and choice of for this place? Is it the same thing as no further state of existence? Thank you for your translations and teaching. No problems, Marion. Good to see you again. That particular phrase is a phrase which is used when the Buddha's talking about somebody who's an arahant who's reflecting as a perfected one on their experience. And they realize that because they have uprooted the defilements and attachments that lead to rebirth, that therefore that they're not going to be reborn anymore. So I think I formally translated it as something like a state of existence or something, and I'm not sure exactly what Bhikkhu Bodhi is using for it these days. It's one of those phrases which is quite idiomatic in Pali. The Pali phrase is itatta, which literally means thisness. That's the literal meaning of it. It literally means thisness. So this is why people have sort of translated in a few different ways. So sometimes if you want to make it a bit more explicit, then you could say for this state of existence. Or if I try to sort of have a sort of in-between translation, nothing further for this place. But we know from a number of occurrences, such as Hanidana Sutra in Diga 15, mm-hmm. that it does in fact mean, you know, there's no more getting reborn into this samsara, basically, is what it means. So it's one of the many idioms for that. And so, of course, in Pali there are many expressions and we have to try to express them in a way that's both faithful to the Pali as well as going to mean something in English would be nice, yeah. All right, so now for this course, I have in my head a kind of a map of how this course is going to go. We began with an introduction to dependent origination. We then looked at the creation mythologies and how they relate to dependent origination. We then checked in with some details about the terminology and the grammar of dependent origination. So we got fairly technical last week with those things. For this week and probably next 1 or 2 weeks, what I'm going to do is to look at, I'm going to do a bit of a greatest hits from the Nidana Samyutta, So we're going to look at a few of the shorter teachings on dependent origination, and I won't be going I'll just be touching on some different suttas. I won't necessarily be doing like a full thing on each of the suttas, but we'll be looking at some of the highlights of particular suttas, and we'll be bringing the learning that we had to that. Then once that is done, we're going to be looking at the practical applications of dependent origination. There's a number of suttas in the Nidana Samyutta that talk about that. Finally, we're going to be doing the big one that you're all waiting for, and I'm going to put this on off as long as possible. I'm going to refute all of the wrong understandings of dependent origination. That'll be fun. It's always fun to explain why other people are wrong, especially when they're not in the room with you. It's great. So that's going to be in a few weeks' time. And then if you're standing or sitting, if we're still alive by that point, I'd like to do a final one, which will be more of a philosophical reflection around the topic of dependent origination. So that's the kind of in my head is how this course is going to proceed. So for this week, we're going to be looking at a number of suttas. Now, hopefully, we have the background to see some of the shorter suttas in light of the main understanding and main statements that the Buddha said. And so we'll bring that to, and hopefully that will clarify some different aspects. But I also want to make these next couple of sessions especially very open for questions, because this is the time to clarify some of those doubts or problems that we have. So please do pop anything in the questions that you would like. The selection of suttas for this period is going to be a little bit random. I don't have a, I've got a few suttas in mind I would like to cover, but they're not in any particular order. So I'm just going to be starting. I'll pop the ones into the chat as we go, and then we will see as we proceed. Okay, so let us begin with the Nātumhaka Sutta, or that's, if I can have that to click, great. I'll just pop that into the chat. This is Samyutta 12.37. And this one, the Buddha begins, "Mendicants, this body doesn't belong to you or to anyone else. It is old deeds, and it should be seen as produced by choices and intentions as something to be felt." All right. And a learned noble disciple carefully and rationally applies the mind to dependent origination itself. When this exists, this comes to be. Due to the arising of this, this arises. When this doesn't exist, this doesn't come to be. Due to the cessation of this, this ceases. Ignorance is a requirement for choices. Choices are a requirement for consciousness. That is how this entire mass of suffering originates. When the ignorance fades away and ceases with nothing left over, choices cease. When choices cease, consciousness ceases. That is how this entire mass of suffering ceases. Okay, so this is fairly typical of a lot of the shorter suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya, where we find the main sequence of dependent origination is present, but it's abbreviated, right? It doesn't present the whole thing every time. Sometimes it doesn't even present it, right? So sometimes not every sutta in the Nidana Samyutta actually has the 12 links. It also has the abstract principle, which we discussed last week, when this exists, this comes to be, and so on. So that main bulk of the sutta actually is common with what we have already discussed. But the interesting part, of course, is the introduction, where the Buddha makes quite a memorable statement about the nature of the body and the nature of life. I'll just repeat this. This body doesn't belong to you or to anyone else, right? Nayang bhikkhave kāyo tumhākaṁ napi anyesaṁ. Again, just notice some of the learning that we picked up from last week. The pronoun here is ayang, which is the pronoun of presence, right? This body. It's old rather than that body, right? So it's not looking at somebody else's body, it's looking at this body, imameva kāyo. It's old deeds, right? Purāna kāma, right? Purāna midang bhikkhave kāma, right? This is old deeds. Yeah, should be seen as produced by choices and intentions, as something to be felt. So this is a really critical line here, right? Mm-hmm. So to be produced by choices and intentions is abhisankatang abhisanchetayitang, right? Produced by abhisankata, from the same root as sankara, right? Produced by choices. Abhisanchetayitang is from the same root as chetana or intention. Okay, so these are two words which we find used together in this sense in the suttas, right? Produced mm-hmm. by choices and intention. So this is one of the many ways that we can see that the word sankhara in this context, in fact, does mean intention, right? It's used here purely side by side as supporting synonyms, as is such a common Pali idiom, as something to be felt, right? Or perhaps that would be better to be translated as verniyang datavang, to be translated as something to be experienced. Okay, you could translate it either way, but it's from the word vedana, the same as in feeling. But you can see, like I left it as to be felt, because in the context of dependent origination, you can see that the choices, the sankharas, then lead through consciousness, name and form, salayatana, right, the six senses, then contact, and then feeling, yeah, all the way down there. So you can see, actually, this is expressing the same thing. We've missed out a few, yeah, and it's going straight from sankharas to feeling. So once we understand the full sequence of the 12 links, then we can see these other ones. We can see, this is what the Buddha's doing here. So the point about this is that this body, which we think is so precious, and we give so much time and care for, we feel so ashamed when it is wrong, right? I mean, we all think that we're above it with, I'm not attached to my body. When was the last time you wandered around naked in public? Right? Probably not recently, yeah? And why, right? Well, we did look at the story of Genesis recently, which discussed that same issue. But the fact is that we're attached to our body. What would people think, right? And, you know, maybe you're afraid of getting arrested or something like that. But, you know, that's not really the reason you don't do it. The real reason you don't do it is because you'd be ashamed, right? Is that right? Why wouldn't you go around? Otherwise, safety. Safety, you wouldn't go around naked because you'd be safety, yeah. Is that just another kind of attachment to your body?
Yes.
It's another kind of attachment to body. Okay, but attachment to body, of course, can be either productive or unproductive, right? So if we're attached to the body by way of like narcissism and desire and so on, but if you see your body as being your friend and your companion for supporting you in your spiritual practice, then that's, you'd look after your body just like you look after a friend. So we look after our bodies and we take care of them and we respect them, but we recognize that this body is an inheritance from old deeds, right? It's a very kind of suggestive idea here, right? It's old deeds, past lives. We did things we've got here. I mean, it's also, of course, a product of old deeds in this life, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be only past lives. If we hadn't eaten in this life, then, well, we wouldn't be here. I mean, we have to look after our body in any case. But primarily, this is the main thing that's been talking about here. So produced by choices and intentions. So one of the things that's so characteristic of the Buddha's teachings, of course, is that the Buddha placed the mind as very fundamental to everything. And even though, obviously, in one respect, the body is produced through material conditions, but it's also, as a body, is sustained through the mind and through our intentions and our actions and our deeds. Then a learned noble disciple. So one of the things here is that dependent origination, like for those who are not yet enlightened, who are on the path to realization of the Dhamma, then we reflect about dependent origination, we investigate it, we can learn it, and we can apply it in our own experience and so on. But somebody who has realized at least stream entry, at least that first stage of enlightenment, has seen dependent origination in a way that is very vivid and unmistakable, and which allows them to let go fully and permanently certain of the attachments and fetters that are binding them to suffering. So that when a person has that ability or has that realization, then they have the capacity to then further reflect and deepen their understanding of dependent origination. We know from the Mahanidana Sutta, the very famous introduction, that the Buddha scolded Ananda for thinking that he knew everything about dependent origination. And as wise as he was and as realized that he was, he still didn't understand everything about it, right? So you've seen it, but having seen something doesn't necessarily mean that you know everything about it, every dimension, every implication. So they carefully and rationally applies their mind to dependent origination itself. This is something that I learned actually when I was on a retreat in Perth. I did this one retreat where you do like these solo retreats. You go into a kuti for 2 weeks and just practice. And at that time, my meditation was going well, and I was really enjoying that retreat, and it was really nice, and I decided to take up dependent origination as a theme of reflection. And one of the things that I really realized through doing that was that everything became so much more clear and became so delightful. Like to think about dependent origination became so joyful because you could see the reality of everything that was happening. And it was just like, oh, yeah, this is, I can see, this is my mind. This is what's going on. Oh, yeah, now I'm making these choices. And it's just this feeling like you're in a familiar landscape, a place that you know and you understand, and that you're not like lost and confused in this forbidding landscape of darkness, which is, I think, how our mind often is. And so through meditation, we gain a kind of clarity to be able to reflect on dependent origination. And of course, the terms that are used here together are sadhu kang yoniso, carefully and rationally. So yoniso means according to causes and conditions, right? So it means inquiring through causality, and is very characteristically used with dependent origination. Okay, so that's the introduction of this sutta. Anyone have any thoughts or questions about that? How's your old karma going?
Is that what Purana means?
Purana, yeah. Okay. Yeah, Purana means old or bygone or past, yeah. Okay. Rini, yeah.
When you said about body being a result of intention.
Right. Intentions and choices. Sankharas and chetanas.
Does that mean that we could wish for how we appear?
Yeah, for sure. So Rowena is asking whether you can wish to have for how you appear, or to wish for, yes. And so this is actually in the Sankhara Upapatti Sutta, where the Buddha teaches that we, if you want to, you can wish to get another kind of rebirth and get reborn in a particular realm, or so on and so forth. So you can do that if you want to. Not necessarily, the Buddha wasn't saying you should. But he's saying that if that's your thing, then, yeah, you can. And, of course, that has to be within the capacity of your karma, right? So you can't live a dissolute life of horror and nihilism and then say, hey, I want to be a Brahma in the next life or something. It doesn't work like that. But if it's within the scope of your karma, then, yes, you can focus your mind and direct to some degree the place where you're going to be reborn. Yeah. Tamara mentions, a little off topic, but sometimes I feel so much of my life is about taking care of my body, right? And yeah, right, we do that from the first thing. We wake up in the morning and go to the toilet, brush our teeth, have some breakfast, do all of these kinds of things. We have to constantly be constantly doing all of this work to take care of our body. And it's kind of interesting that in the society we live today, we live in a world where it should be easier than ever to take care of those fundamentals of the body, right? To have enough food to eat and all of those things. And you think that people would be like, okay, that's good. You know, body's all right. That's fine. You know, we've got good medicine. You know, we've got food. We've got those things we need. We can now turn our attention to higher things. But it seems that perhaps a lot of people are not ready for that step and become more and more obsessed. And the obsession with the body becomes such that it becomes like this like overwhelming and you know, like obviously unhealthy kind of obsession with, like, you know, distorting the body, changing it and altering it and trying to make it into the best that you can. Like, even like in an extreme example with people like transhumanists who then want to create a new body as a computer or a machine or something like that. So yeah, a bit of moderation. The Buddha was always a great fan of moderation. Yeah, look after the body, it's fine. Have a bit of gratitude, it's fine. But yeah, nothing is going to stop you from getting old. Yeah, sorry about that. Sorry to break that to you if that's news for anyone.
I think the word sankata.
Sankata, yeah.
So I'm asking this just to explain, say some more things about sankata, because nibbana is a sankata. Right?
That's correct. Yeah.
So sankata is like.
So sankata is the past participle from sankara. So if sankara is the doings, then sankata is the done. Yeah. Right. So sankata basically means what has been produced by sankaras, right? It's been made, if you like, right? So if sankara is a choice, then the sankata is what is chosen. But if sankara is, let's say, the energy or the activity of conditions, like, because sankara sometimes is like all conditions, all phenomena that is caused by something, then asankata as nibbana is not caused by anything. So in that case, it means not conditioned or not caused by anything, including, of course, not being conditioned by choices, but not just that. It means not conditioned by anything at all. Yeah. All right, let's have a look at another one and see where we get. So this next one is the Cetana Sutta, another very short but quite memorable discourse. Mendicants, what do you intend or plan, and what do you have underlying tendencies for? Become a support for the continuation of consciousness. When this support exists, consciousness becomes established. When consciousness is established and grows, there is rebirth into a new state of existence in the future. When there is rebirth into a new state of existence in the future, future rebirth, old age and death come to be, as do sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness and distress. That is how this entire mass of suffering originates. If you don't intend or plan, but still have underlying tendencies, this becomes a support for the continuation of consciousness. When this support exists, consciousness becomes established. When consciousness is established and grows, there is rebirth into a new state of existence in the future. When there is rebirth into a new state of existence in the future rebirth, old age and death come to be, as do sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness and distress. That is how this entire mass of suffering originates. If you don't intend or plan and do not have underlying tendencies, this does not become a support for the continuation of consciousness. With no support, consciousness is not established. When consciousness is not established and doesn't grow, there's no rebirth into a new state of existence in the future. When there's no rebirth in a new state of existence in the future, future old age and death, future rebirth, old age and death cease, as do sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness and distress. That is how this entire mass of suffering ceases. All right, so this is another one of these kind of interesting short suttas. So again, it emphasizes the role of sankharas, choices, intentions, karma, all of them very similar in meaning. And here we have another word which is added as also very similar meaning is pakapeti. Right, so pakapeti we find used less commonly in the Pali, but has a similar kind of meaning. It's from the same root as sankapa, as in sama sankapa and the Noble Eightfold Path. So in this case, it's another synonym for volition, will, intention, and so on. Okay, so what you intend and plan, and what you have underlying tendencies for. Okay, so we haven't met underlying tendencies previously in the context of dependent origination. So these, of course, are the anusaya, and there are seven anusayas typically. Can anyone remember what the seven are? I'm just trying to think if I can remember what the seven are. Seven anusayas. Anyway, there's seven of them. And so it's another name for defilement. But what's necessarily interesting about these is not necessarily the list of defilements themselves, but like what the meaning of them and like how, what the role that they play. So in Buddhist theory, and this is now, I'm now talking about commentarial Abhidhamic theory. So we have basically three levels of defilements, all right, which correspond to the three kinds of training, sila, samadhi, panya, the ethics, meditation, and wisdom. So the first level, the most obvious one, is those defilements that express themselves through misconduct of body and speech, okay? And those defilements we curb, we counteract with practice of sila, keeping precepts, living a good life, okay? Now, that's why the practice of keeping precepts and the practice of sila is so essential to Buddhism. It is a fundamental tenet of Buddhist practice that the reason you do bad things is because you have unwholesome tendencies in your mind, right? And I just want to dwell on this a little bit because this topic has come up for conversation recently. There are many people who argue falsely that you can be an enlightened being and still do bad things. And there are plenty of gurus going around who are abusive, who commit sexual assault, who do all these kinds of terrible things. And somehow their devotees manage to rationalize in their mind, oh, yes, I know he's enlightened, therefore this must be a lesson, this must be good for me. And then they hold them within themselves, this contradiction, that somehow he's enlightened. I mean, it's almost always he's enlightened and yet he did these terrible things. I'm not saying that women can't be false gurus as well. If you want to be a false guru as a woman, I support your right to do that. I don't necessarily encourage you, but you certainly can. Okay, I'm just saying that in my experience, mostly blokes, then he's enlightened and he hurt me, right? So I must deserve it. I must need that pain. It must be good for me. And people find ways to rationalize that. Even people who've suffered a lot of abuse, people who've been traumatized for many years, still, I see these people still making attempts to rationalize and justify that the person who did that abuse somehow is still realized or is still wise and they're not just an asshole. And I want to say to them, please, it's okay. We're all dumb. We all make mistakes. It's okay. He's just an asshole. Just don't, it's that part of your life. Just leave it behind, you know, and move on. And we don't have to try to rationalize or justify these things. All right. So so this is why fundamentally on a Buddhist level that, you know, we can't, you know, you can't be enlightened and be doing bad things. Now, obviously there are boundary cases, right? There are cases where you can have a difference of judgment about what is the right thing to do and so on, right? And, you know, you find this discussed in ethical texts and things like that where there are problematic issues. I think it's just the wind, yeah. Or a ghost, one of the two. So that's sort of separate, right? So there obviously are issues where you might disagree with what somebody does, but you can still see that that's like a reasonable, you know, difference of opinion or different choice. Yeah. So this is the ethical conduct. Number two is, so certain defilements are I'm not quite finding the word that I'm looking for, are constrained or are quieted by the practice of the precepts. Then there's the practice of meditation. And this is the one that where we mostly see them. Like you, when you keep your precepts, right, you are counteracting certain kinds of defilements that would be coming up, but you're not necessarily really aware of that. Yeah, you can keep precepts without actually really being aware of your own defilements and so on. You're just following the rules, right? And you're not necessarily conscious of how that is working. I mean, ideally we are, but we're not necessarily. But when it comes to meditation, you can't avoid that, right? You're just sitting there and they're just in your face and you're like, oh, yeah, okay, right. That's why the Buddha called them defilements, right? They're, and you feel those things inside you and they're inescapable and painful and shameful and just nasty. And so you're like, okay, what am I going to do? And because we are struggling with these things, we feel like we're not good meditators. Everybody feels like they're not a good meditator. But it's the fact that you're struggling with them that is what makes you a good meditator. Okay, anybody who comes to me and says, I can't meditate because my mind's full of anger and greed, I'm like, great, this is normal and fine and good. Someone comes to me and says, oh, I sit down and meditate and my mind's immediately clear and I perceive the formless realm of the unconditioned element and so on, I'm like, come on, this is a bit of a worry. I mean, maybe you are, okay? I'm not saying it's not possible, okay? It's just statistics, that's all. So, fine. So meditation, we're overcoming those defilements. It might be not, we might be sitting there, we might be angry with somebody. We're not actually yelling at them, right? But we feel like we'd like to at that point, right? And we maybe spend like a whole hour in meditation justifying to ourselves why it would be right and good for us to yell at them, you know? And but we restrain ourselves, and through restraining ourselves over time, we learn to free our mind from that second level of defilements. These we usually call the hindrances, especially the five hindrances. Then overcome through samadhi. And then finally is the level of defilements, which is the anusaya, right? So the level of defilements that are underlying. And these defilements are things that we can't necessarily see all the time, or at least are very subtle to see. We can only really see them through the deep development of insight meditation. So something like when, you know, normally in dependent origination, the Buddha talks about the three defilements, right? There's ignorance at the beginning, and then later on there's craving and grasping, right? So we have those three. And here the Buddha is talking about the same thing using another term, anusaya, the underlying tendencies, okay? And there's a specific reason for talking about defilements in that way in this particular context, which we'll come to in a minute, okay? But it's the same. So even though we're using slightly different language, okay, here it has cheteti, chetana, and pakapeti instead of sankara, and it has anusaya instead of ignorance, but it's still basically the same thing. And then that's the support for the continuation of consciousness. So this is still the same as the first three factors. Okay. Right. Uh-huh. Okay, fine. Then when the support exists, there is a support for the continuation of consciousness. This is the aramana, is the support. Then consciousness becomes established. When consciousness is established and grows, there is rebirth into a new state of existence in the future. So the idea of growing is quite prominent in the discussions of dependent origination, especially for consciousness and for similar things as well. It's organic. And I think that this aspect of consciousness is often kind of overlooked in Buddhist theory. Like, we tend to look at consciousness purely as a kind of a mental concept or mental reality that is there and has various attributes and conditions and so on and so forth. But the Buddha frequently talked about consciousness like a plant, right? So the word that, when it says that consciousness becomes established, I almost translated this as consciousness is planted, right? In fact, elsewhere the Buddha says, vijnanam bijam, consciousness is the seed. So literally is a seed. So it's a seed which is being planted and which grows. And that kind of organic, holistic approach to consciousness, I think, is really essential to the way that the Buddha thought about consciousness. So what that rules out, for example, one of the things it rules out is the consciousness as epiphenomenon idea. So this is a kind of quite a common idea in modern materialism, which basically is that consciousness doesn't exist in the world, but it arises at a certain point as an epiphenomenon of matter when it is organized in a certain way. Normally, we call that organization a brain, but we might also call it one of these computers or something like that. It could be any kind of machine, but ultimately, there's no consciousness, and at a certain point, consciousness pops up. And the analogy there would be something like, let's say, a screen on a device, right? So we can see a screen. It has all of those things and colors and all of those movements. We can see movies. We can all of that stuff. It happens on a screen. But none of that is there when you're building the screen. There's just different parts. And there's zero consciousness. There's zero light on the screen until every part is there and it's all wired up and it's plugged in. And when that happens, the screen lights up and you can see things. So this is a bit like the epiphenomenon theory of consciousness, right? So consciousness is something that just pops up at a certain point when everything's kind of wired together the right way. And you can see this is really the kind of driving metaphor that's underlying the AI industry. They want to produce artificial consciousness. They have a neighbor at the door. And then in contrast, the Buddha's idea is that the consciousness is there all along, right? There's no point at which consciousness pops up. It's part of the fabric of things right from the beginning. So consciousness when we say that consciousness is then produced by ignorance and choices, it doesn't mean that there wasn't any consciousness beforehand. Of course there was, right? There's always been the consciousness, has always been this stream which is evolving and changing from life to life, right? But these are the things that are driving it. These are driving the consciousness. They're not sort of creating it out of nothing. And so again, you can see here that the goes from consciousness to then to rebirth in a new state of existence in the future. So it's then skipping out name and form, six senses, contact, feeling, craving, grasping, bhava, and going straight to bhava, which is the existence, right? So you can see that all of these are then skipped out and we just go boop, boop, to the end. So again, this is like showing you another perspective. I can see in this particular sutta, the 12 links are not found, right? But they are implicit in what's been said there. So this is why it's really important to have a really good grounding on the 12 links, and then you can see all these different variations and understand why they're presenting it in a different way in this particular case. And so there is, of course, a very specific reason for this. So we then go on. The next bit is the one which is kind of unique to this particular sutta. If you don't intend or plan, but you still have underlying tendencies, then this still becomes a support for the continuation of consciousness. Kind of interesting, right? So we normally have ignorance and choices leading to consciousness, right? So what this is saying is that even if you don't do the choices part, okay, the ignorance part, which here is called anusaya, underlying tendencies, is still going to lead to consciousness. Yeah, it's still going to lead to getting reborn in the next life. Kind of interesting, right? So why is that? Well, presumably because of the choices from the past, right? So your ignorance and underlying tendencies are still going to manifest because of what you've done in the past, even if you're not making a new karma in the present. So I'm kind of, the sutra is not entirely clear what exactly that it means by not making choices in that kind of way, right? I mean, it's kind of a bit difficult to imagine what life would be like without making any choices, but perhaps we could apply this to a newly born baby, all right? Newly born baby, and this is a simile that Buddha gives in the Majjhima Nikaya, doesn't have any craving or is just sitting there, right? It's not really doing anything. It's not making any choices. right? It kind of learns how to make choices. But in itself, I mean, babies can't vote and those kinds of things. So it takes a while to learn how to make choices. So I think that probably this is for babies, perhaps maybe for animals, or at least maybe some beings in the animal realm. I don't know. Maybe some beings in other realms as well. I do feel like a lot of sometimes as those of us who are neither animals nor babies go through life, making choices is a hassle. And we feel like we would really rather avoid having to do that. And I think that going through life saying, oh, I'm not going to make a choice about anything is not what it means here by not making choices, right? Because making the choice to not make a choice about something is a choice. Yeah. So as monastics, we do this, and sometimes we do this in extremely annoying ways. Yes, Deepika nods, yes. And for example, we won't tell people what we want to eat. And, you know, this happens to me on alms rounds, you know, most of the time people come and give me some food. It happened the other day. This lady came, oh, I want to give me something, blah, blah, blah. What would you like? Oh, anything is fine. No, 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 please tell me what you like. Anything vegetarian is fine. No, no, please, you must tell me. Same Buddhism, you offer what you want to eat when you go to heaven. Okay, that's fine, but tell me what you want. So... but anyway, so we try to at least reduce the amount that we're making those choices. So anyway, fine. So okay. Another time maybe also when we're asleep. Right, we're not making choices when we're asleep. There's no intentional action. This is actually discussed in the Vinaya as well, right? So there's in the Vinaya that there's certain offences which, you know, you're not going to be guilty of if you're asleep or if you're dreaming or something like that. So I think, and the Buddha says there's no intention which is present. So I think that also could be another case, maybe if you're unconscious. Yeah. Yeah, Simran.
Is sleep considered a state of unconsciousness? Because there's a tradition where they practice something like sleep yoga, trying to be more aware of what's going on, and then using that to sort of surpass the limits of the body. So, for example, like jumping off buildings and things
And while you're asleep.
When you're asleep, to realize that's more than just your body.
Do not do that under any circumstances. In Buddhism, sleep is considered to be, it's not considered to be, I mean, technically, it's not unconscious, right? Because obviously, there's still consciousness. If there's a loud noise, then you wake up, right? So there's still some kind of subliminal consciousness. It's usually explained in Theravada tradition. They explained it as being what they call bhavanga chitta, at least this deep sleep, is where there's mind is just basically sort of perpetuating sort of the basic functions of the mind, but it's not really doing anything. So from a Buddhist point of view, no, you don't have this idea that you're going to be like training the mind through like lucid dreaming or anything like that. That actually draws on like ideas you find in the Upanishads, where they have a lot of passages on sleep and dreaming. It's actually a major philosophical theme of the Upanishads and one of the major differences between the Upanishads and the suttas. It's interesting. The way the Upanishads talk about sleep and dreaming is really interesting. And I feel, I'm not an initiate in that tradition, but I believe that it is partly talking about actual sleep and dreams, but it's partly also a secret language for talking about meditation. Yeah, I think it has those two dimensions. It's like a way of hiding talking about higher meditation states. Yeah. It's one of the problems with reading Upanishads. They deliberately make things as obscure as possible so that outsiders can't understand them. Yeah.
So, Bhante, would a non-returner still be capable of making choices, do you think?
Is a non-returner still capable of making choice and making karma? Sure.
Right.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. even though it's like it's just the mind, right?
Like, right, but they still make karma, but it's still very residual, right? Mm-hmm. So it's only just that little bit of attachment that's left. Yeah. All right, so got a couple of comments here. Great, Venerable Dhammakipa, thank you so very much. Seven anusayas, underlying tendencies or obsessions. What did I translate it at one time as? Inherent tendencies, inherent compulsions. I translated it at one time, like a compulsion, like it's something that's not necessarily there, but even if it does, when the time comes and it's stimulated, it will come up. Karma raga, sensual desire or sensual greed. Padiga is aversion, resistance. Ditti is wrong views. Vichikicca is doubt. So those four are overcome by a stream mantra. Then there's mana or conceit or the idea I am. Bhavaraga is craving for existence. And so bhavaraga, especially for the non-returner, means craving to get reborn. You know, you still want to get reborn in those high Brahma realms and to sort of bliss out on jhanas for like another few eons. And the Buddha said, if you're going to have an attachment, that's the best kind of attachment to have. And lastly, avidya or ignorance. So you can see that even though avidya is not explicitly mentioned in that particular sutta, it's actually implicit in the anusayas. Which thank you very much, Venerable Dhammakipa, for supplying that. Chandima asks, what's the difference between anusaya dhamma and sanyojana dhamma? Basically, it's the same, but slightly different ways of talking about it, right? So each of these different names for defilements has a slightly different underlying metaphor that expresses them in a different ways, right? So the word like kilesa or asava means something like a pollution or something that dirties something or defiles it. Sanyojana is a fetter, something that binds, something that holds on and constricts, whereas anusaya is something that underlies, right? Anusaya is probably the closest idea to the unconscious that you have in Buddhism. So it's something which is underlying or inherent. And it may be active, but it may just be biding its time. Yeah. So Christelle asks, maybe a stupid question. Yes, maybe, Christelle, but maybe not. Also, she finds it difficult to differentiate craving and grasping. Could I please explain again? I would love to explain again for you, Christelle. That would be a great honor. Thank you so much for asking. So we talked about this a couple of times, and so sometimes with these subtle things, then it can, you know, take a little while for it to sink in. And just so you know, like I believe that this is something that's, you know, that the different Buddhist teachers and Buddhist texts and so on will also struggle to differentiate these a little bit. So it's not just you. Basically, craving, as I understand it, craving is a more primal, primal desire, primal urges. Okay, whereas grasping is more intellectual. It's a more sophisticated form of defilements. So craving is what a animal feels, whereas grasping is what a scholar feels when they see someone who's written a comment on their a review of their book and they're furious that they misunderstood their book so much, and so they have this kind of grasping. So you become, you identify with like views, you become identified with theories of yourself and so on and so forth, and they become it's more learned, like you learn to grasp, you learn to have grasping, whereas craving is something that just like comes out, you know, just So that's really what I think the difference is. Craving is more foundational, more fundamental. Grasping is more more developed, a bit more sophisticated. Okay. So if you don't intend or plan but still have underlying tendencies, then this becomes a support for the continuation of consciousness. And so I feel that this is maybe also a response to Jain idea a little bit as well, because they kind of had this idea that you can sort of burn off all your past karma just by, as long as you were not performing new karma, that you could burn off all your old karma. And so this is something which the Buddha also criticized. Anyway, so that's that one. And then the last one, if you don't intend or plan or have underlying tendencies, this does not become a support for the continuation of consciousness. With no support, consciousness is not established, and then there's no rebirth in the future. All right, Simran.
So then if somebody realizes Nibbana, then what happens to their karma then?
If somebody realizes Nibbana, what happens to their karma? Then if somebody realizes Nibbana, then the karma will either just be exhausted and not come to fruit, just like seeds cast onto rocky ground, or the karma that they've done might manifest in this life. Often in a more attenuated way. So the classic example would be Angulimala, who of course was a killer, and became a monk, became enlightened. But he would go on alms round, and people would throw rocks at him, and the Buddha would say, "Well, yeah, it's better than what would have happened if you'd got reborn." Yeah, so that was just the residue of that karma was still experienced by him. So the suttas aren't really definitive on the point. Do you have to experience all of that past karma from the past? There's a few slightly different takes about that in the suttas, actually. But generally speaking, either you experience it in a somewhat attenuated form, or it just evaporates.
But then what would be the difference between that and the Jain idea of it?
The Jain idea is based on the idea, okay, I'm going to like force myself to be still and not doing anything, so therefore I'm not going to be making any karma. But of course, by doing that, you're still making a choice, so you're still making a new karma. And so they want to burn off the old karma by causing pain. So they believe that that experience of pain. So remember, we talked about the body as being old karma. Similar kind of idea, right? So the body manifests as old karma, and the feelings to be felt is not entirely dissimilar. But the Jain idea is that if the old karma is to be felt, I just feel everything and then I burn it off. And so they burn it off with tapas, which is literally burning. So they like literally causes much pain, which creates a fire inside the body and literally burns off all that old karma. And the Buddha pointed out, well, you're actually doing something when you're doing that, right? So that's you're actually making new karma while you're doing that. Yeah. Sorry, I was just thinking about this Jain couple I met in Harris Park the other day, who I feel like I have to kind of balance this. I can do like a philosophical critique of Jainism, and that's all right. But every single Jain person I've ever met has been the most delightful person. Mm-hmm. And this Jain couple sort of happened through Harris Park and saw me, and they were just like so thrilled and so delighted to be able to give some food and some offering to a monk. So that was like really nice to see. Okay, so sorry, yes. Eka, yeah.
So this, the 12 limbs, is it really sequential?
Okay, so is the 12 limbs really sequential? Great question. So yes and no is the answer. So in a certain sense, yes. And there are certain cases where you can say, you know, there definitely is this kind of a sequential thing there, for example, like contact and feeling, right? So you first of all, you contact, and then feeling is a response to it. So there's definitely a sequence there, and it doesn't go the other way. Huh? Actually, that's discussed in the Dhatu Sangyutta, which is also in the same collection. But in other cases, it's not, right? In other cases, and you can see in a sutta like this one, that and the one we looked at before, that the different parts can be substituted and so on. So the best... the best metaphor, the best way of thinking about dependent origination is in terms of a spiral. All right. So think about a spiral for a minute. Yeah. So if you talk about dependent origination, you talk about it in a line, right? Yeah. Words have a line. And this is why it talks about it in different ways, because it's showing you that it isn't actually strictly linear, because we can take this bit out and put this bit out here and so on. So we can make certain changes to that linear process, right? But it doesn't mean you can make any changes, right? You can make some changes. Now, in the Wheel of Life, the Bhava Chakra in Tibetan, then they have its dependent origination is a circle, and you sort of go around and get back to the beginning, which is another way of depicting it visually. right? So the problem with that is that it's not actually really a circle, because you don't actually go back to the beginning, because it's never the same. It's actually impermanent, right? But a spiral is partly linear and partly circular. You keep going around the same patterns, right? But it's never exactly the same. Right? If you look at it from far enough away, it looks like a line. Yeah, like you think of like a spring, and you look at it from far enough away, it just looks like a line. But if you look at it from above, it looks like a circle. It's going round and round. So it depends on your perspective. But actually is a spiral. And so like DNA, right, like a coiling snake, actually you see these spiral shapes all the time in nature, in galaxies. Yeah, it's interesting, right, isn't it? There's a kind of fundamental shape in nature that you see all the time. And so that aspect of a spiral, yeah, you can see you're kind of coiling around, and why we keep feeling like we're doing the same old thing. Sorry, I was stumbling because I was thinking of a Pink Floyd lyric there. Running over the same old ground, what have we found? The same old fears. Venerable Bhairatna, he knows what I'm talking about. So, and yet everything's new all the time as well, right? So this is really that, to my mind, that's the most useful metaphor for thinking about the shape of dependent origination.
Can I ask another question?
Please, yeah.
So it's not like if you break some, like the six, number six, whatever it is, and then 7, 8, 9, 10, and 12, and go on,
uh-huh.
You left 1 to 6.
Okay.
That's like linear, right?
Right.
Just now you explained it, like the past karma, you didn't make any karma in this life, but the past karma still come back to you.
Right.
So what's the, it looks like the core is just like the first three, like definitely if you see there's no ignorance at all, they mean you're free.
Right.
But after that, they still look like the first three is the most important bit.
Okay, like so... So the question there is about like whether you can't
core of it, man. It's like the core, and then the
right,
other one is
right. So you can't just end it and then end that process, right? Yeah. And you can see again that's something, it's kind of like something that people do, right? So you think of something like, so people don't want to feel. Like feeling, people spend a lot of their lives managing their feelings. They want to feel nice things, they want to feel pleasant things, and if they don't get to feel pleasant things, they'd rather not feel at all. So you take some drugs. Or you do something that's going to make you not feel, or you just kind of numb yourself out in front of the telly, or just whatever, do something mindless that's going to just shut your mind off. And so people actually a lot of the time want to not feel, but of course then that doesn't actually work because you're not really ending that cycle. So traditionally the cycle is really ended at any of the defilements. So remember I talked about the three vata, the three cycles. So the first one is the defilements, and that's the ignorance or craving and grasping, okay? In this sutta, it's anusaya. It's the same thing, right? Then the kama is the next one, is the sankharas, and then lastly is the resultant, right? So with the resultant things, you can't end everything, right? Right? So you can try to do that. You can say, well, I'm going to be contacted with something, but I'm not going to feel anything. You can try, right? So in meditation, we kind of do that. It's not that you don't feel anything, but you moderate your feelings, right? So your feelings become more subtle, so that you're not overreacting to things, so that you can see things more clearly. But there's still a feeling there, right? So, so you can't do it with the resultant things, right? And what this particular sutta is saying is you can't end it with the active things as well, with the karmavata. Specifically, that's what this sutra is saying, that just by not intending, you also can't end dependent origination. It has to be with this kilesavata. So that's ignorance, craving, grasping, in this case, anusaya. So these are the things that can end. So there are some presentations which we might come to, which shows how it ends with craving and grasping rather than with ignorance. So again, these are different kind of turns of the spiral. Yeah. Nina.
So does that also relate to the comment you made about when you were
for a few weeks.
Right.
You have joy from the clarity. So
right.
Let's say you have clarity of something that's painful.
Right.
There still be that sense of joy.
If you have clarity about something that's painful, do you still have the sense of joy? Sure. Yeah. And that's one of the meanings of freedom. Mm-hmm. It's not that you don't feel the pain, but that you're not trapped by it. Yeah, the pain is not controlling you anymore, you know. So if you've got like trauma or anxiety or something from the past, you know, this is why, like, you know, people will drink or they'll do something to just try and blot it out, you know, which is, you know, work for a few hours or whatever. But the Buddha's path is not to blot it out, but it's to not be controlled by it. That's the really the thing. It's not that bad things happen. It's that bad things don't let us go and we can't go get on and live our life. Yeah. Parinyaya, have to fully know it, right? Know it all the way through, exactly, yeah. So, oh, Dhammakipa's excelling tonight, giving the textual references not just to the suttas but also to Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd. That's excellent. Thanks, Honorable. okay, so another question here from Venerable Prasanna. So Venerable Prasanna asks, is upadana taken out for animals and lower beings then? I think upadana is not fully functioning in lower animals, yes. And this is why I think that generally speaking, animals don't make very much kamma. So I'm not saying they can't make any kamma at all. I'm just saying that generally speaking, we don't regard the animal realm as being sort of as karmically potent as the human realm because grasping, you know, upadana still includes karma, right? So you still have karma upadana, it's still part of it, but it's not fully functioning with all of the four factors of upadana, of grasping. So this is why, yeah, I think animals, we let them get away with stuff and it's okay. And we don't think that a dog is making bad karma if it's like barking at someone or something like that. It's just, you know, it's just a kind of behavior. All right. Venerable Dhammakipa worked in the music industry almost all of her life. Really? She's often imagined dependent origination as many overlapping spirals, some large and some small, some going forward and some backwards, some moving quickly and some slowly. Yeah, beautiful image, yeah. That's right, because within the sequence itself, we can also see different spirals working. It's not just one. Yeah, it's very fractal in that kind of way. Same as in nature, spirals happening, you know, at the DNA level and then at a cosmic level as well. Yeah. Okay, Janet asks, Bhante, grateful if I can explain and elaborate the following from the Nikuddhika Nikaya. The Udana mentions cutting the round, and it is the point at which it is cut is feeling by not allowing craving to respond in feeling. That kind of alluded to a little bit previously as well, and that we find that also in the Sanyutta Nikaya. I'm not sure if it's one of the suttas that I had pulled up for today, but it is in the Sanyutta Nikaya as well. So that's the other point. If you can practice to be able to let go either any of those points in the kilesa vata, right? So the ignorance, craving, or grasping. Technically, we can let go of dhamma, let go, and it's really just different ways of talking about the same thing. Actually, like one way of thinking about that. So this is where dependent origination starts to get really interesting, and because so far it's been really boring, but this is where it starts to get really interesting. Is you start to see the subtleties of these things once you get familiar with it. Okay, so the relationship between ignorance and craving. Okay. Ignorance and craving. Ignorance is a cognitive defilement. Craving is an emotional defilement, right? So not only is it possible to overcome those two things, right, but the meditative means of overcoming those two things, ignorance is overcome with vipassana, insight meditation, and craving is overcome with samatha, right, with samadhi meditation. Because they develop their complementary ways of developing the mind, right? And so you can see that actually these two turns, like, so we're seeing the different turns of dependent origination, the spiral, but these are not just arbitrary. Like the reason why the different factors are chosen and arranged in that form actually has a specific meaning, and they can relate to our practice in different ways as well. So these are some of the subtleties that we may be drawing out later on. Yeah.
So are the seven anusayas
yes.
arranged in a similar way? So there are like some kind of structure, I'm thinking that the goal is to break down that anusaya and get rid of them.
Mm.
So does it mean that, you know, do the first three first and then the next one? Is there any order?
Do you want to do the first three anusayas first and then do the other ones?
Does it work actually?
To a certain degree, yeah, to a certain degree. So the anusayas which are overcome by a stream mantra are generally speaking the more obvious ones, right, and the easier ones to overcome. So that specifically is the wrong views and the doubt, right? And so you can see that like wrong views and doubts, and these can be overcome through study of Dhamma and so on and so forth. Yeah? Then is the karma raga and the desire and the lust, right? So in terms of the fetters, the stream mantra still has those, and they're gradually overcome because they are very powerful sort of fundamental forces, right? And then lastly is the more subtle ones, especially the conceit and the craving for rebirth in subtle, you know, continuation of existence in a subtle form. Yeah. So, yes, there is that difference, yeah. Ten fetters and seven anusayas, yeah. Mostly similar, yeah. Sakkaya ditti, which is included in the fetters, yeah. But in the anusaya, it would just be under ditti. So it's phrased a little bit differently, but it's basically similar. Okay. And then Arimutta, we'll have to have one more question for tonight, and then we'll have to end up. Arimutta asks, could it be said that sankharas are like the conscious personality and sense of identity, and the anusayas are the subconscious programming? It certainly could be said that that is the case. Whether one should say it is another question, but it certainly could be. Sankharas are like the conscious personality and sense of identity. I wouldn't say exactly that. They're certainly to do with the conscious sense of identity, right? Sankharas are more explicit in the mind. I wouldn't exactly phrase it in that way, but I think it's not. It's close. I mean, sankharas are. I mentioned before about development and growth, and so sankharas are really, if you think in terms of human life, are really developed by teenagers. Actually, like we don't really think of kids, like little children, as being morally responsible in the same way. And we're not saying that they're entirely not morally responsible, right? But still, we don't throw them in jail if they nick something.
We do. Oh, God. I know that's the racist country we're in.
Sorry. Yeah, let me revise that. Yeah.
Yeah.
We accept that it's morally wrong to throw children in jail for nicking something from the shops. Yeah, we might do it anyway, but we still think it's wrong. But anyway, look, generally, they're developing that sense of sankhara. And that's, of course, one of the big struggles that teenagers go through, because they're learning how to be responsible for their actions, but they're still idiots because they're teenagers, so they don't know how to do it responsibly, so they keep messing up all the time, right? And so that's kind of and a big part of that is why in the teenage years also, you know, you're having to develop your own sense of identity and figure out who you are. And, you know, once that's kind of developed, that's more or less what we call maturity, is when you kind of know who you are and you understand what are the choices you're making as a mature adult, you know, and this is when you take responsibility for those choices. One of the defining characteristics of what we would consider a mature adult is that they take responsibility for their choices. So there's certainly something to that. I wouldn't quite express it the same way. Anusayas are like subconscious programming. I guess, again, kind of, yeah, it's a similar kind of idea. It's not subconscious programming necessarily in the sense, though, in psychology, it's more like habituation, right, which can be again kind of morally neutral, really. I mean, it's a stimulus and response thing, but it is certainly something that has been conditioned in a certain way, like because of the choices we made in past life, right? It's conditioned and it's shaped our underlying tendencies in a certain way that it's going to respond to things in this life in a certain way. So even though we all share those underlying tendencies and we all might be in a similar situation, but we'll respond to it very differently. Somebody might have their first drink of alcohol and then end up becoming an alcoholic. Somebody will have their first drink of alcohol. Or I think like me, the first time I ever smoked a cigarette, you know, nicked some of my mum's cigarettes. Sorry, mum. And went off to smoke them. And I literally had one puff and I was like, spat it out. And I was like, oh, my God, that's horrible. Why would anybody do that? And that was literally the only time that I smoked a cigarette. So, yeah. Highly recommending giving cigarettes to children, you know, if you want to. Only kidding. All right. So we should wrap up there. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for those who came along for the Temple of Humanity here in Parramatta. Thanks for those who've joined us online. Next week we will be back, same place, presumably same place. We're still not entirely settled for our physical location for these events here in Sydney, so please do just keep your eye out. I'll post any changes on the Look Hunter website, and they'll also be posted on the Signal group if you're a member of that. So we do plan to be back here, but we're still keeping our eye out for other venues as well. So Wednesday nights, of course, still at Crow's Nest Centre. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.